The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, December 6th, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I'm your guide for today. We are about to jump into one of the most sprawling, complex, and just fascinating stacks of source material we have pulled together for you. Our mission, as always, is simple: to execute a really comprehensive and exhaustive deep dive and extract the most important insights, the surprising nuggets, and the critical context that you need to be well informed right now.
And I am Sam Astor. And the scope today is, well, it's massive. We are moving with some real velocity across every major domain: finance, politics, global affairs, technology, and culture. We're not just looking at the headlines. We're analyzing the implications of these tectonic shifts that affect everything from the future of Europe to the stability of your 401k.
And the opening headlines alone could give you whiplash. The front page is just dominated by two massive private company valuations, both speaking volumes about where capital and momentum are flowing.
Right.
We have Netflix's gargantuan $72 billion acquisition dominating the media landscape. And then right next to it, you have SpaceX soaring to an $800 billion valuation target,
which officially makes it the most valuable private U.S. company, surpassing OpenAI.
Exactly.
These numbers are, staggering, and they signal these profound strategic shifts. The Netflix deal is all about consolidation and, you know, building an impenetrable IP moat. The SpaceX valuation, on the other hand, is about infrastructure, government reliance, and the successful commercialization of technology that was, until recently, only reserved for nation states.
Okay, let's unpack this monumental media merger first. Netflix agreed to buy Warner Bros. Studios and the entire HBO Max streaming business for a massive $72 billion. But the structure here is everything, isn't it?
It truly is. This is not a straightforward merger of the whole Warner Bros. Discovery company. It is a strategic carving out of the pure creative assets.
So what are they leaving behind?
They are splitting these businesses from Warner's traditional, you know, legacy cable networks, the CNNs, the TNTs, the TBS of the world. Those will be left as a separate publicly traded entity. This structural element is really the key to understanding why this deal happened and why Warner accepted it.
And the sheer size of it for Netflix is, I mean, it's historic.
It is. This cash and stock offer, which valued Warner Bros., Discovery shares at $27.75, gives the acquired assets an enterprise value of around $82.7 billion. For Netflix, a company that famously built its empire rather than bought it, this represents a fundamental strategic pivot.
A pivot toward acquisition.
Exactly. They're doing it to ensure they maintain content supremacy globally.
Yeah.
They feel they have to buy their way into the next phase of growth.
Now, here's where the high-stakes financial drama comes in, because there was a rival bid. Paramount and Skydance actually offered a higher initial per-share price, $30, all cash. So why did Warner reject the higher cash bid?
Well, it comes down to a really calculated, complex assessment of residual value. Paramount wanted the entire company, including those, you know, declining cable assets.
Right.
Warner Discovery's leadership, specifically the CEO, David Zaslav, believed that by accepting the lower raw per share offer from Netflix for the studios alone, and then allowing their existing shareholders to retain shares in the newly separated debt-free cable network company.
Okay.
The combined value post-split would actually land somewhere between $31 and $32 per share.
I see. So they were betting that the market would value two streamlined, focused companies more highly than one sprawling, integrated, and frankly, debt-laden media conglomerate.
Precisely. It was a sophisticated financial move designed to maximize shareholder value by specializing the assets.
That makes sense. Netflix is acquiring a generational content catalog, HBO, Warner's film franchises, all that prestige TV that they could never have built on their own in a reasonable time frame.
No.
But they've promised the market and analysts that HBO Max will remain a standalone entity. What's the strategy there?
Well, the strategy is flexibility and market segmentation. The Netflix CEO, Ted Sarandos, called it a rare opportunity to secure their position for the next decade. By keeping HBO and HBO Max separate, they can bundle the services at a discounted price, they can offer them individually, or, you know, even use them to attract different global demographics.
And they're arguing this makes it pro-consumer.
Right. They argue this choice and potential for cheaper bundled options makes the deal pro-consumer. But fundamentally, this acquisition is about building a massive intellectual property moat and, crucially, locking down the elite creative talent associated with HBO.
But the shadow over this entire deal, which Netflix wants to close within 18 months, is the massive political scrutiny and the almost guaranteed antitrust hurdles.
The regulatory challenge is monumental. The Justice Department is expected to launch an intense investigation. Combined, Netflix and HBO Max would control approximately 30% of the U.S. subscription streaming market.
And that 30% number is key, isn't it?
It's the magic number. The current federal guidelines, which were established during the Biden administration and retained by the current one, stipulate that mergers between direct competitors are often presumed illegal if the resulting entity controls over 30% of the market. Netflix is right on that line, forcing them into an extremely difficult legal defense position.
And the political dimension is just, I mean, it's dripping with drama.
Absolutely. Paramount explicitly argued that the Netflix deal would never close because of these challenges. And on top of that, we know that President Trump is close with the Paramount CEO, David Ellison.
Oh.
That dynamic introduces the possibility of direct political pressure being applied to antitrust enforcers to steer Warner toward the rival all-cash Paramount bid, which, you know, would have fewer antitrust implications globally.
So how is Netflix defending themselves against this core accusation of creating a near monopoly?
They're focusing on two core arguments. First, they are redefining the market. They argue that the relevant market definition shouldn't just be subscription streaming.
They want to include, what, YouTube.TikTok?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It must include free video platforms like YouTube, Facebook, and TikTok. If you include those, their 30% share suddenly looks a lot smaller.
Okay.
Second, they are stressing their pro-innovation stance, pointing to the decision to keep HBO Max standalone and the potential for lower bundled prices as evidence that they won't reduce consumer choice or stifle competition.
But the political opposition they face is bipartisan, which is often the death knell for deals this size.
That's a critical point. On the left, you have Senator Elizabeth Warren calling the deal an anti-monopoly nightmare. And then on the right, Senator Mike Lee, a staunch conservative who's often skeptical of regulation, stated the deal raises serious competition questions, perhaps more so than any transaction I've seen in about a decade.
Wow.
The level of risk they're taking is reflected in the extraordinary $5.8 billion breakup fee they agreed to pay Warner if the deal fails to win regulatory approval.
That's a huge number.
It signals immense confidence in their legal team,
okay,
but also, you know, a profound fear of failure.
And we can't overlook the personal victory this is for Warner Discovery CEO David Zaslav.
Oh, this deal is his complete vindication. For years, he was pilloried in Hollywood for aggressive cost-cutting, canceling films, the decline of the stock post-2022 merger.
Right, he was not popular.
Not at all. But the stock soared on this news, achieving its highest market cap since the initial merger. It shows that his strategy, which was prioritizing the creation of high-profile, desirable studio assets while strategically shedding the sinking ship of linear cable, it successfully delivered what the market wanted, a pure-play content engine that a buyer like Netflix desperately needed.
Okay, let's pivot from the content wars to the literal space race and the jaw-dropping speed of SpaceX's growth. We're talking about an $800 billion valuation.
It's truly astonishing. This secondary share sale values SpaceX at $800 billion, firmly cementing its place as the most valuable private U.S. company, surpassing OpenAI, which was the previous record holder.
And to give you some context on the speed.
To give you some velocity context, this valuation is double the $400 billion valuation they achieved in a previous share sale not that long ago. So the public markets are now keenly anticipating an initial public offering, possibly as early as 2026.
Given the challenges facing some of Elon Musk's other ventures, what is the core driver justifying that kind of velocity and scale for SpaceX?
It comes down to two dominant, incredibly high-margin business lines. First, they're near monopoly on the commercial launch market, particularly with the Falcon 9. And second, the explosive and, frankly, vital growth of Starlink.
Starlink is the key infrastructure piece, isn't it?
Absolutely. Starlink now boasts over 8 million active customers globally. It's providing high-speed internet in some of the most remote and challenging environments, including being an essential communications backbone in the war in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But the valuation is also heavily underpinned by stability derived from the U.S. government. SpaceX has deep and lucrative ties to the Pentagon, the intelligence community, and NASA, handling critical missions, astronaut transport, and classified satellite projects.
So this isn't just a tech company.
No, it's an integral part of the American defense and infrastructure apparatus.
And their future growth plan shows no sign of slowing down.
Not at all. They are investing massively in Starship development, that enormous next-generation rocket system crucial for ambitious deep space missions, including NASA's eventual moon landing. But more immediately commercially relevant is their recent commitment of over $20 billion in cash, stock, and debit to acquire EchoStar Spectrum.
And what's that for?
That acquisition is designed to fuel their future direct-to-cellphone satellite link division. This is a game changer. They're moving beyond fixed ground terminals and aiming to integrate satellite service directly into consumer mobile devices.
Effectively ending mobile dead zones worldwide.
That's the goal. This capability targets a market that is orders of magnitude larger than traditional satellite broadband.
Shifting to another arena of technological rivalry, let's talk about the furious war for AI chip supremacy, where NVIDIA has been the undisputed champion.
NVIDIA's dominance has been, well, absolute. It's been driven not just by their superior graphics processing units, or GPUs, but crucially, by their proprietary software ecosystem known as CUD.
The software is the key.
CUD has locked in generations of AI developers, making it extremely difficult to switch to rival hardware. That software moat is their true advantage. I mean, their sales have been phenomenal, hitting $147.8 billion in 9 months, and the company briefly topped a $5 trillion market valuation, making CEO Jensen Huang a global icon.
But that dominance is now facing existential pressure from multiple very well-funded directions, starting with the traditional chip rivals.
Right. AMD, under CEO Lisa Su, made a strategic pivot 3 years ago, reorienting their entire company toward AI, which has resulted in their market cap nearly quadrupling since.
And Broadcom.
Broadcom is now a $1.8 trillion behemoth that specializes in custom XPUs optimized for specific data center tasks. And Qualcomm, primarily a mobile chip maker, has unveiled new AI accelerator chips focused on high memory capacity and energy efficiency, directly challenging NVIDIA's power consumption metrics.
But the most intriguing challenge, and maybe the most dangerous one for NVIDIA, is coming from the very companies that spend billions buying their chips, the hyperscale cloud providers.
That's where the disruption is deepest. Amazon Web Services, or AWS, and Google are now actively selling their advanced, internally developed chips TPUs from Google, Trainium, and Inferentia from AWS to outside customers.
So they're competing with their own supplier.
Exactly. Google has used TPUs internally for years to power its search and AI models, but now they are a commercial offering being snapped up by giants like Meta and Apple. AWS is making similar moves, building data centers based around their chips for major AI players like Anthropic. Analysts are increasingly suggesting that this trend of vertical integration could signal the beginning of the end for NVIDIA's near-total market control.
And then, even beyond the cloud giants, their own biggest customers, the AI labs themselves, are going DIY.
That's the other shoe dropping. Companies like OpenAI and Meta are realizing that to optimize their models for cost and efficiency, they need application-specific integrated circuits, or ASICs.
So, custom chips tailored for their own needs?
Precisely. For their unique computing needs. OpenAI is partnering with Broadcom to design its own silicon. Meta acquired the startup Revos to bolster its internal chip development. Even Microsoft plans to rely more heavily on its custom accelerator chips. So while no one expects NVIDIA to crash overnight, this rapid diversification means the superlative growth trajectory investors have gotten used to will be incredibly difficult to sustain.
This technological intensity spills naturally into the critical legal fight over content and intellectual property. We see the New York Times suing Perplexity,
right,
accusing the AI company of profiting by stealing and using its copyrighted content to train models and generate answers.
This lawsuit just crystallizes the core global legal battle. Who owns the digital commons, and how is AI allowed to ingest and use human-created material? The outcome will likely determine the financial model for journalism and creative industries for the next generation.
And speaking of regulation, the European Union is flexing its muscle, confirming that major global powers are setting hard boundaries for content.
Yeah, we saw Elon Musk's X platform fined about $140 million by the European Union for breaching the bloc's landmark digital content law. The EU is taking its Digital Services Act extremely seriously, actively establishing rules that govern the flow of information, misinformation, and illegal content, creating a complex and costly operating environment for these massive U.S. tech firms.
Let's briefly look at the broader financial shifts underpinning all this technology. U.S. stocks finished the week strong.
Yes. The market sentiment was overwhelmingly positive. Stocks ended the week near records, driven by the strong expectation that the Federal Reserve will implement an interest rate cut next week.
And the anticipation of cheaper money.
Exactly. It tends to fuel market optimism and risk-taking.
And this optimism also fueled a notable commodity surge.
Copper prices climbed to a record high. That's driven by two factors: continued fears of a global supply shortage and the anticipation of those rate cuts, which usually boost demand for industrial commodities. It's a classic signal of expected economic expansion.
We also saw a significant regulatory rollback that has major implications for the multi-trillion dollar private credit boom.
U.S. regulators rolled back rules that had previously limited the amount of risk banks could take in corporate lending. These rules were initially designed post-financial crisis to ensure stability.
So what does the rollback do?
It essentially lowers the hurdle for traditional banks to participate in riskier corporate debt and feed the burgeoning private credit industry. This indicates a regulatory environment that is actively encouraging lending activity, further accelerating the growth and complexity of the private debt market.
And finally, how are American consumers feeling as the year draws to a close?
Well, consumer sentiment showed a slight improvement in the preliminary December reading, rising to 53.3 from 51 in November. The previous drop was largely blamed on the uncertainty and disruptions caused by the autumn government shutdown.
But it's still not great.
No. While it's an improvement, the mood remains subdued. The index is still far below the 70-plus readings we saw in January, suggesting that the cumulative impact of previous economic shocks, high tariffs, and political instability is still significantly weighing on the average American household's outlook.
From the world of trillion-dollar finance, let's transition into a critical discussion on public health, domestic policy, and legal showdowns that are challenging decades of precedent.
And we have to start with the truly controversial news from the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP. This is the body that determines the U.S. standard for public vaccinations.
And they voted 8-3 to entirely eliminate a standard recommendation that has been in place since 1991.
Correct. The ACIP voted to nix the recommendation that all newborns receive a first dose of the hepatitis B vaccine immediately after birth. This is a foundational public health recommendation credited with drastically reducing the prevalence of hepatitis B, a virus that is a leading global cause of liver cancer and liver failure.
So, what does the new guidance actually recommend?
The new guidance suggests that if the infant's mother tests negative for hepatitis B during the first trimester, the parents should then consult with a doctor on whether the early dose is necessary. For infants skipping the birth dose, the first dose shouldn't be administered until at least 2 months of age.
That sounds like a purely medical decision, but the context here is highly political.
It is entirely political. This vote comes after the ACIP committee was dramatically remade by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who pushed out all of the previous long-serving members.
And the president weighed in.
Immediately. President Trump immediately praised the new panel's action on social media, hailing it as a very good decision and directing the CDC to review global best practices. This signals a direct clash between the established public health consensus and a new administration prioritizing vaccine skepticism and parental choice.
What are the arguments the new ACIP majority used to justify this dramatic reversal?
The proponents argued primarily from a stance of parental rights and perceived low risk. They claim that if the mother tests negative, the risk of the baby contracting the virus is minimal, making the universal birth dose an unnecessary intervention that violates parental rights.
Okay.
One obstetrician member stressed that parents are often unaware of the number of medical procedures their infants undergo in the first hours of life. They also cited potential, though importantly, unproven by high-quality randomized controlled trials, risks related to autoimmune conditions. The core philosophy is just reducing unnecessary exposure and maximizing parental choice.
But the established public health community is issuing grave warnings against delaying this vaccine. What is their scientific counterargument?
The critics cite decades of exhaustive safety data, which has consistently shown no unusual harms associated with the birth dose. Their major practical concern is that mothers can be infected after the initial first trimester screening, meaning a negative test early in the pregnancy is not a guarantee of safety at delivery.
I see. And it can be spread in other ways.
Crucially, yes. They stress that hepatitis B is also spread through non-maternal transmission shared items like washcloths or toothbrushes, meaning the risk is not zero, even if the mother is clean. Delaying the vaccine just increases the window of vulnerability. Dr. Jason Goldman, a liaison to the panel, explicitly accused the new ACIP leadership of promoting an anti-vaccine agenda. It's a genuine clash.
And following that dramatic vote, the panel also changed guidelines on post-vaccination testing.
They did. The ACIP also voted 6-4 to recommend that insurers cover antibody testing for children after a dose to determine if further doses are needed. While the birth dose will remain covered by federal insurance programs, this change in recommendation for universal dosing creates a financial risk.
So private insurers could drop coverage.
Some private insurers in various states may seize on this change to drop coverage for the initial dose, potentially creating new financial and logistical barriers for parents, even those who want the vaccine.
Moving from the CDC to the Supreme Court, we have two landmark cases being heard this term that challenge the fundamental structure of American law and governance. Let's start with the one challenging birthright citizenship.
Right. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear the Trump administration's appeal on the constitutionality of the executive order, attempting to end birthright citizenship, denying citizenship to children born on U.S. soil if neither parent is a citizen or permanent resident. This is a deliberate challenge to the long-standing understanding of the 14th Amendment.
What is the administration's core legal argument regarding the 14th Amendment?
The administration argues that the text of the 14th Amendment, which states that all persons subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. are citizens, was originally adopted to confer citizenship on newly freed black Americans. Solicitor General John Sowers contends that this clause was never intended to apply to children of illegal immigrants or temporary visitors.
And their framing is that it degrades the gift of citizenship.
Right. The administration maintains that allowing citizenship through this mechanism degrades that gift and dilutes its meaning.
But the challengers, the families involved in the class action suit, argue that the court settled this a long, long time ago.
They rely heavily on the 1898 Supreme Court case, United States v. Wong Kim Ark, which cemented the interpretation that the 14th Amendment applies to virtually all persons born on U.S. soil, with only narrow exceptions for diplomats and enemy military forces.
And they're calling the administration's case, what, a jumble of misstatements?
A jumble of historical misstatements and policy preferences, arguing that overturning over a century of precedent would cause catastrophic administrative chaos.
The second major Supreme Court case, Trump v. Slaughter, challenges the very existence of the independent regulatory state.
This case asks if the president can fire members of the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, at will. The implications are enormous because it directly challenges the 90-year-old precedent set in Humphrey's executor from 1935.
Right, which established that agencies like the SEC, FCC, FTC need to be insulated from presidential control.
To ensure expert nonpartisan regulation. That's the whole idea.
So if the Supreme Court sides with the administration here, what happens?
The administration argues that since the FTC exercises vast executive power regulating everything from corporate mergers to consumer protection, it must be accountable to the chief executive. If the court agrees, it would profoundly destabilize American governance.
How so?
Congress structured dozens of administrative agencies in reliance on that 1935 rule.
Mm-hmm.
Overturning it could make the leaders of these massive, powerful bodies instantly fireable by the president, making them directly subservient to the White House's political agenda. It raises serious questions about the nature of nonpartisan enforcement.
Speaking of accountability and transparency, a federal judge has ordered the release of long-sealed grand jury transcripts related to the investigation into Jeffrey Epstein in Florida.
This action was mandated by the new Epstein Files Transparency Act, signed by President Trump last month, which explicitly supersedes the normal, stringent rules of grand jury secrecy. The transcripts relate to federal grand jury investigations convened in 2005 and 2007.
And the goal is to find out why federal prosecutors didn't charge him back then.
Exactly. The aim is to finally provide transparency regarding why federal prosecutors in Florida failed to charge Epstein, who later pleaded guilty only to state charges in 2008.
This transparency move is facing legal pushback, though, even from unexpected corners.
Yeah. While the public clamors for the details, Ghislaine Maxwell's legal team is already arguing that the release of these grand jury materials could compromise her right to a fair trial in any future potential retrial. This perfectly illustrates the legal tension between the public's right to know and individual due process protections.
Now let's turn to a scandal that has jumped to national attention and involves a truly staggering scale of corruption, the Minnesota Somali welfare fraud. We are talking about over $1 billion.
The scale is unprecedented. The fraud exceeded $1 billion, involving dozens of Minnesota residents of Somali descent, focused primarily on three areas: federally funded child nutrition programs, housing assistance, and autism services. Authorities recently charged the 78th person in these cases. Nearly 60 defendants have been convicted so far.
So how exactly did these systems allow for $1 billion to be stolen?
The fraud often started with a federally funded child nutrition program during the pandemic, which relied heavily on trust and rapid disbursement. defendants created bogus rosters of children and claimed to open feeding sites that, in reality, were sometimes just vacant commercial spaces or parking lots where no food was ever served.
And the spending was lavish.
Unbelievably so. One 24-year-old defendant who stole $900,000 spent the funds on a honeymoon in the Maldives, $30,000 on jewelry in Dubai, and a luxury Dodge Ram pickup. The fraud expanded into housing assistance, where costs exploded from a projected $2.6 million annually to $104 million last year. Funds were traced to Kenyan real estate and luxury cars.
The political reaction has been ferocious, drawing in major national figures and sparking investigations.
It has. House Republicans launched a formal investigation into how this pervasive corruption was allowed to fester under Democratic Governor Tim Walz. President Trump immediately weighed in, calling Minnesota a hub of fraudulent money laundering activity and issuing a highly charged threat to end temporary protected status for Somali immigrants, stating, "Send them back to where they came from."
How has the Somali American community itself responded to this scandal and the subsequent rhetoric?
A Somali American professor at McAllister College condemned the fraud as a despicable act and a civic betrayal. However, he strongly criticized Trump's comments as unhinged and racist.
Mm-hmm.
Conservative columnists, meanwhile, seized on the scandal to argue that lax progressive policies and excessive political correctness enabled the corruption, arguing that when welfare becomes too easy to access and oversight is minimal, it invites large-scale criminality.
That discussion of the breakdown of public trust naturally leads us to the scrutiny facing trust in journalism and political media, specifically the story concerning Olivia Nussi and Vanity Fair.
Right. Nussi and Vanity Fair have mutually agreed to part ways as her contract expires, following renewed scrutiny regarding an affair with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and questions about her journalistic conduct while reporting on him. This is particularly complex because she had previously parted ways with New York Magazine in 2024 after the relationship became public.
What exactly revived the questions about her ethical conduct?
The publication of her new book, American Canto, which details an affair with an unnamed politician. This, coupled with scathing Substack posts from her ex-fiancé, the political journalist Ryan Lizza, who claims she acted as a political operative for Kennedy, reopened the entire ethical debate.
So it's the perception of a conflict of interest.
Exactly. Even though an earlier internal investigation found no factual inaccuracies in her previous Kennedy profile, the perception that a journalist may be acting as an operative for a subject raises profound questions about the impartiality and trust essential to political reporting.
Overlaying all these domestic issues, the political friction, the breakdown of trust, is a frightening documented rise in what the paper calls incipient political violence across the country.
The sources paint a stark picture. The tempo of political violence is accelerating and broadening in scope. We see a worrying string of recent high-profile attacks. The assassination of conservative figure Charlie Kirk at a rally in Utah, the firebombing of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's residence.
And the targeted shooting of the UnitedHealthcare CEO.
Yes, Brian Thompson, who was targeted due to anger over insurance coverage protocols. And that's not all.
We also saw violence directed at law enforcement near the White House.
That's right. Two members of the West Virginia National Guard were ambushed while on patrol, resulting in the death of Specie Sarah Beckstrom. This rise is further quantified by the U.S. Capitol Police, who reported that threats escalated dramatically from fewer than 2,000 per year a decade ago to almost 10,000 last year. It signals a genuinely dangerous fracturing.
And Peggy Noonan's column was pointing at its critique of how high-level rhetoric plays a role in this trend.
Her analysis centers on President Trump, arguing he is less careful in what he says than any previous president, and dangerously sets a menacing, dehumanizing tone that can give permission to unstable people to act violently. She specifically criticized his isolating attacks on female reporters using demeaning language like ugly both inside and out and quiet. Quiet piggy.
And the White House has a webpage for this.
Yes. The White House's creation of a wall of shame, webpage tracking reporters accused of misrepresenting the administration, is condemned as institutionalizing these attacks, giving them an official imprimatur that can embolden unstable individuals. Her conclusion is a stark warning that this rhetoric guarantees tragedy.
Moving from critical domestic instability to massive global realignment, let's turn to the latest U.S. national security strategy, which seems to have completely redefined America's relationship with its closest allies in Europe.
This document, which outlines the current administration's global priorities, landed in European capitals like a bucket of cold water. Historically, these documents reserve their harshest rhetoric for rivals like China and Russia. This version reserves its deepest criticisms for Europe, painting America's traditional allies as wayward, declining powers that have ceded their sovereignty to the European Union and lost their way.
That language sounds like a profound strategic break from the post-World War II alliance. What specifically is the strategy warning Europe about?
It uses extraordinarily strong, charged language. The strategy warns that Europe faces potential civilizational erasure through uncontrolled immigration, suggesting the continent could become unrecognizable within 2 decades. It even accuses many European governments of subversion of democratic processes. Wow. The core message is that Europe is growing too weak, too reliant on supranational institutions, and too focused on regulation to remain a reliable ally.
This shifts the U.S. role entirely, doesn't it? From Europe's ally against Russia, the U.S. is repositioning itself.
That is the crucial interpretation. The document positions the U.S. as an arbiter between Europe and Russia, rather than Europe's primary defender, opposing Moscow, which has been the fundamental U.S. role since 1945. It explicitly calls for an end to NATO being a perpetually expanding alliance. Timothy Garton Ash, a prominent European historian, called the document the mother of all wake-up calls, advising European leaders that they must assume the traditional transatlantic partnership is dead.
If the U.S. sees Europe as wayward, what is the stated goal of this strategy toward its former allies?
The analysts who study the document read it as an active attempt to reshape Europe in the U.S.'s image. The strategy explicitly states the goal is to cultivate resistance to Europe's current trajectory within European nations.
That's controversial.
It's highly controversial. It implies that the U.S. is actively looking to interfere in European domestic politics, potentially supporting far-right, nationalist, or anti-immigration parties to steer the continent away from what it views as regulatory suffocation and back toward civilizational self-confidence.
We see clear evidence of instability and highly complex shifting alliances globally, starting with a shocking story of ransom payments to a major terror group.
This is deeply worrying news. The United Arab Emirates, a key U.S. counterterrorism partner, paid over $20 million to Al-Qaeda's powerful West Africa affiliate, JNM, to secure the freedom of an Emirati prince kidnapped in Mali.
And the ransom wasn't just cash.
No. Critically, the ransom package included the release of dozens of Islamist extremists imprisoned in Mali.
This sounds like a massive infusion of funds and resources right when Al-Qaeda is making gains.
It is exactly that. The influx of millions of dollars and, just as importantly, experienced fighters and organizational muscle comes as JNM is actively besieging Mali's capital, Bamako. This dramatically raises the possibility of Mali, a nation of 25 million people, becoming the first country effectively governed by an Al-Qaeda branch.
Moving to Gaza, we see the failure of Israeli post-war planning following the death of an anti-Hamas militia leader.
Yasser Abu Shabab, the leader of the Israeli-backed Popular Force militia in Rafah, was killed. His death underscores the deep complexity and fundamental flaw in Israel's strategy of trying to build up armed Palestinian resistance groups to diminish Hamas's power.
So this militia wasn't effective?
No. It was notoriously prone to infighting, lacked organic popular support, and was even accused of looting aid convoys. Analysts suggest the death complicates efforts to establish viable armed alternatives, indicating that this strategy has failed to significantly erode Hamas's political or military power.
On broader peace initiatives, we have movement on both Ukraine and Gaza governance.
On Ukraine, U.S. and Ukrainian officials met for a third day of talks regarding a post-war security framework. They released a sobering joint statement stressing that any real progress toward an agreement is wholly contingent on Russia demonstrating a genuine and serious commitment to long-term peace and de-escalation.
And in Gaza.
Regarding Gaza, an international body, the Board of Peace, chaired by President Trump, is expected to be announced by year-end. This body will operate under a 2-year UN mandate to oversee Gaza's extensive reconstruction efforts.
And finally, in oil diplomacy, the U.S. is applying increasing pressure to test the energy lifeline between India and Russia.
Indian Prime Minister Modi recently hosted Russian President Putin. India has provided a crucial economic and diplomatic lifeline to Moscow by purchasing sanctioned Russian crude oil at steep discounts since 2022. That relationship is now under severe strain from 2 major factors imposed by the Trump administration. New 50% tariffs on Indian goods.
As punishment for buying the oil.
Right, specifically for buying sanctioned Russian oil. And new secondary U.S. sanctions targeting entities that continue to trade with Russian state oil firms. So both Modi and Putin are maneuvering to maintain their mutually beneficial energy relationship while trying to avoid total antagonism with the U.S.
Geopolitics is even spilling into the world of light entertainment, causing turmoil in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah, the contest, which prides itself on unity, is facing a major cultural and political schism. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands, and Slovenia announced a boycott of the 2026 contest because Israel is still allowed to participate despite the Gaza war. Russia was, notably, kicked out in 2022 after its invasion of Ukraine.
How is the European Broadcasting Union handling this internal division?
They avoided holding a formal vote on banning Israel due to immediate counter-boycott threats from some of the biggest participating countries, including Germany, France, the UK, and the host, Austria. This is essentially creating a divided political contest rather than a unified cultural one.
And the situation is being framed by some columnists as a spectacle of anti-Semitism?
That perspective argues that the countries pushing the boycott ignored the fact that a ceasefire was in place. Furthermore, they cite implausible complaints about the voting results that saw the Israeli singer Yuval Rafael, a survivor of the October 7th Hamas attack, place second after receiving a very strong public vote, despite a middling professional jury rating. This is viewed by observers as part of a wider trend where anti-Semitism has become so pervasive that it is now threatening institutions meant to foster cultural exchange.
From global conflict to global commerce, let's transition to the remarkable success of the upscale outdoor brand Arc'teryx, which has transitioned from niche gear to a powerful global status symbol.
Arc'teryx is a fascinating case study because it has successfully conquered the Chinese market, which is something many traditional luxury brands like Gucci and Louis Vuitton have struggled with recently.
And they're famous for their $1,000 jackets.
Yes, their $1,000 waterproof jackets with the distinctive dinosaur fossil logo. And they've become the uniform for finance bros and streetwear enthusiasts worldwide.
What specific strategy allowed them to succeed in China where others are failing?
They are riding a fundamental cultural shift in China. As the real estate boom slowed and the economy cooled, wealthy Chinese shoppers began pulling back from flashy, ostentatious luxury logos. Instead, there's a pivot toward valuing perceived high quality and a new cultural emphasis on outdoor activities. Hiking, skiing, camping.
So high quality is the new high end.
Exactly. Arc'teryx gear is seen as the absolute pinnacle of quality and performance, making high value the new high end, even if the wearer is only using the jacket for a city commute.
And their parent company played a crucial role in enabling this expansion.
Absolutely. Arc'teryx's parent company, M. Miller Sports, is controlled by China's largest sportswear company, Anta Sports Products. Anta leveraged its extensive local knowledge to secure prime real estate for large retail stores. They also received the ultimate celebrity boost when Chinese leader Xi Jinping wore an Arc'teryx parka at the 2020 Winter Olympics opening ceremony.
And they control their own retail.
Yes. CEO Stuart Haselden also shifted the brand away from third-party retailers toward vertical retail, meaning 75% of sales now come directly from Arc'teryx stores and e-commerce platforms, giving them total control over pricing and customer experience.
The success has been explosive.
It has. Arc'teryx grew its total revenue to over $2 billion last year, up from $500 million in 2020, with Greater China accounting for a dominant 45% of its total sales.
Now we move to a troubling social story about the black market in high school sports, intensified by the new rules regarding college athlete compensation.
This is the dark, illegal underbelly of the athletic world, perfectly encapsulated by the case of Philip Bell III, a nationally ranked wide receiver now playing for Ohio State. The core practice is the illegal payment of gifted teenage athletes to transfer to specific schools.
And the sources reveal a heartbreaking human cost associated with this system of exploitation.
They detail a truly tragic saga. Court filings revealed that Bell's mother, Samantha Barnes, who had long struggled with addiction and financial problems, essentially shopped him from school to school, demanding as much as $72,000 a year for his transfer.
And this tore the family apart.
Completely. At one point, she and Bell lived in a $7,900 a month mansion, leased with the help of a sportscaster. The pressure and money tore the family apart, and Bell reportedly no longer speaks to relatives. Tragically, his mother died in Las Vegas after heavy drinking and using cocaine. This is the human consequence when a child becomes a valuable, marketable asset.
How has the introduction of legal name, image, and likeness, or NIL, compensation for college players, affected this illegal market at the high school level?
It has acted as gas on the fire, as one NIL consultant put it. While NIL is legal for college athletes, the massive flow of money and the professionalization of the entire system provides cover and incentive for the illegal high school market.
So the street agents are more active than ever.
Absolutely. They routinely broker these deals, dangling cash, cars, jobs, and allowances, ranging anywhere from $20,000 to $100,000 to broker transfers, often using cash deals with no paper trail.
Shifting to a surprisingly optimistic story about technology and talent, we look at the renowned mathematician Ken Ono, who is making a profound pivot into the AI world.
Ken Ono, famous for his deep work on number theory, consulting on films like The Man Who Knew Infinity, is taking an extended leave from the University of Virginia to become the founding mathematician at Axiom Math. The startup was founded by his 24-year-old former student, Karina Hong.
This move is counterintuitive for a tenured pure mathematician. What fundamentally convinced him that AI was the future of his field?
Ono was initially a profound skeptic, but he was profoundly shaken after attending a symposium where advanced AI models were tested on research-level math problems. He realized how rapidly the models were improving, noting that his lead was shrinking. He had an epiphany that AI wouldn't replace mathematicians, but offered a different way of doing math, acting as a powerful collaborator.
What is Axiom Math's ambitious goal?
Hong's company, which has raised $64 million, aims to build an AI mathematician capable of high-level reasoning, finding new problems, and creating formal, verifiable proofs. They believe this mathematical superintelligence would have enormous commercial applications in logistics, trading, and software verification.
And his decision was also fueled by the political pressures facing higher education today, wasn't it?
Yes, he cited the political environment at UVA, including dealing with the fallout from the president's resignation under political pressure from the Trump administration, noting he was spending too much time on political maneuvering instead of doing math. He saw the pivot to Axiom as a chance to focus entirely on a legacy project.
Finally, let's examine a critical financial development affecting millions of people: the changing and increasingly complex landscape of retirement investing, specifically regarding target date funds. What is the target date trap?
Target date funds are the autopilot choice for most 401k savers. You know, they hold a mix of stocks and bonds, automatically reducing risk as you get closer to retirement.
Right, set it and forget it.
Exactly. The trap is that these simple vehicles are becoming needlessly complicated. Nearly 35% of them now hold two dozen or more underlying funds, including various growth, value, mid-size, and bond funds, creating an opaque jumble that analysts say is unlikely to outperform much simpler, cheaper portfolios.
And this complexity is deeply tied to a critical regulatory gap: the shift from mutual funds to collective investment trusts, or CITs.
This is the crucial mechanism the listener needs to grasp. Employers are increasingly shifting 401k assets from mutual funds, which are regulated by the SEC and require transparent disclosure, to CITs, which are overseen instead by bank regulators. While this initial shift drives down costs for the employer, it introduces lower visibility and greater complexity for the investor.
And that lower visibility seems to be the gateway for the introduction of high-cost, illiquid assets.
Absolutely. CITs are becoming the perfect vehicle for injecting illiquid, expensive private investments, like venture capital, private equity, and non-traded real estate into standard retirement portfolios. These assets carry annual fees that can soar up to 2 to 8% or more.
And the investors are unlikely to notice.
That's the bet. Private asset managers view the $4 trillion plus target date market as an ideal target because the typical investor is predisposed to not acting. This is a massive concern because the hands-off, stable investment of last resort is rapidly turning into one that requires the investor to be a lot more hands-on to understand the true risk and cost.
We've covered phenomenal ground today, from Netflix and SpaceX pushing the boundaries of valuation to the profound challenges facing public health consensus and the rule of law. To bring these threads together, let's look at some cultural and geopolitical reflections pulled from the editorial pages.
We have a deep piece discussing the cultural stagnation of Scotland, viewed through the lens of Scottish novelist Alan Massey.
What is Massey's fundamental critique of his home country?
Massey argues that Scotland has declined into a depressing culture of dependence, passivity, and stagnation. He traces this historical decline back to the industrial collapse following World War I, which resulted in mass unemployment and led to a widespread suspicion of capitalism.
And he thinks this led to a culture of state dependency.
Yes. His analysis is that since the 1960s or 70s, the dominant political thought shifted entirely toward the collective and the belief that only the state could fix things, resulting in a culture of state dependency and a gradual loss of the productive Protestant work ethic.
Does he see any path out of this perceived stagnation?
He does. Ironically, Massey, who was historically an opponent of Scottish independence, suggests that political independence might actually be the catalyst needed to force Scots to take responsibility for themselves. He notes that the rise of the unconventional right-wing Reform Party suggests that the era of slumberous conformity may soon come to an end.
We also had a brief, sharp piece of reflection countering a common historical narrative about the state of global peace.
Yes, it questions the concept frequently cited by political scientists. The longest peace, meaning the period without great power war since WWII. The counterargument stresses that reality has been anything but peaceful, listing wars in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and the current high level of conflict globally. It notes that the past 2 years have actually seen the most conflicts of any time since the end of the Second World War.
So, a reality check on historical complacency.
Exactly.
And finally, pulling all these threads together, the complexity in retirement funds, the massive government fraud in Minnesota, the financial deregulation allowing more bank risk. What is the central implication for us, the well-informed listeners?
The implication is the true collective cost of complexity and exploitation. We see institutions designed for public security and stability, whether that's the regulation of corporate lending, the oversight of social welfare, or the structure of our personal retirement savings becoming unnecessarily complicated or easily exploitable.
So it requires the citizen to be hypervigilant.
That's right. When U.S. regulators roll back rules limiting bank risk, or when Minnesota's social programs are built for $1 billion, or when simple target date funds are stuffed with hidden illiquid assets, it requires you to be hypervigilant. The pressure, as defined by the former Purdue president regarding college sports, is that every participant feels like they have to press ahead or be left uncompetitive. This pressure applies across the board, forcing everyone to take on more risk just to stay even.
That is a massive amount of crucial, synthesized context we've extracted today. We dove deep into the financial velocity of SpaceX at $800 billion and the massive, fraught merger between Netflix and Warner. We covered the political remaking of the CDC's vaccine panel and two massive Supreme Court cases that could reshape the 14th Amendment and the very nature of executive power.
And we explored the rise of political violence, the scale of financial fraud in Minnesota, the geopolitical flip that pits the U.S. as an arbiter against its former European allies, and the structural complexity now baked into stable retirement funds. It truly was a comprehensive look at how technology, politics, and culture are shifting beneath our feet.
Before we close this deep dive, consider this final provocative thought, tying together the themes of legacy and ruthless commerce. The Big Ten Conference, once the moral custodian of college sports, which fought fiercely against commercialization, now struggles with balancing its academic heritage against its identity as an absolute money machine. The question we should all mull is how many of the institutions we rely on, from the CDC's ACIP panel, which jettisoned a 30-year-old public health recommendation, to the Supreme Court, which is challenging a 90-year-old structure of governance, even down to our retirement planning systems, are currently grappling with that exact same existential question. How to cash in on a legacy without fundamentally selling out the core promise of that institution?
A profound and necessary question for an era defined by rapid, often ruthless change.
Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.